Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Writer's Block with me, Morgan O'Reilly, right here on 90.3 Near FM. Coming up on today's show, we've got all the best music, interviews, and of course, all things literary, so stick around. Yes, indeed. Why pamper life's complexities when the leather runs smooth on the passenger seat? Why indeed, Morrissey? Why indeed? Well, you're very welcome to today's show. Get the boring stuff out of the way, folks. Unfortunately, I've got a bit of a dose, so if you hear me doing any coughing or any sneezing fits, let me apologise right now about that. But anyway, on to business. We've got a great show lined up for you today. An old friend of Writer's Block, Caoimhe Creed, she's going to be bringing me around Dublin Castle. I went in a couple of weeks ago, got a fabulous tour of the castle, and I talked to some very talented young writers. Caoimhe is running a writers group in there at the moment, and they're getting all their brilliant inspiration from the medieval cells and the state apartments in St. Patrick's Hall and everything like that. So that'll be in the first half of the show, and of course after 4 o'clock we have our usual visiting writer, and coming in today is Madeline Gray, and she's going to be talking to us about her novel and her poetry and her upcoming novel, which hopefully will be published in the next couple of months. That's after 4 o'clock. But you are listening to Writer's Block 90.3 Near FM with me, Morgan O'Reilly. We are going to take a bit of music right now. Haven't played this fella in a while. It is The Smiths. And this one, it was off one of their compilations. I think it was Louder Than Bombs, released for the American market. Anyway, it isn't really so strange. The Smiths, enjoy. And that was The Smiths with Isn't Really So Strange. Well, as I was saying, coming up next for you, very special. Earlier in the week, I had a tour, a private tour myself, of Dublin Castle to meet Caoimhe Creed and her very talented group of young writers. And we're going to play the recording for you now. It's a fantastic tour of Dublin Castle. If you want to brush up on your history, stick around for the next 20 minutes because we've got an excellent recording coming up here. And there's some really, really good literary stuff in there too. So, without further ado, Dublin Castle, folks, enjoy.
Lovely to see you again.
You too. Nice to be here.
How have you been?
I've been very well, thank you.
It's, I think, almost 2 months since you were on Writer's Block.
Yeah, I think it has been. Yeah, it's been a while.
How's the writing going?
It's going okay. It's not as... I haven't been doing as much as I'd like to. I drowned my computer with a cup of tea, and that's been putting a halt. Now, that might not stop a true writer, but it's stopped me a little bit.
Oh, well, it's a marathon, not a sprint.
Exactly, yeah. I should be scribbling notes on little bits of paper and everything I can find, but no, I've just been mourning the loss of my MacBook.
It's been a long mourning, a long process.
Yeah, it's very sad.
Still wearing black.
Yeah, exactly.
So you're working in Dublin Castle now. That's
yes, I am.
Where we are here today.
Yep.
And we are awaiting the arrival of a couple of very talented young writers.
Indeed.
And that is part of your job here. You are running a writing group for... talented teens?
Yeah, exactly. We're running this like writing group. I mean, I'm just facilitating. They're really doing all the work. I'm taking the credit, but they're doing the work.
Yeah, as it should be.
Yeah, I provide the pens and the pencils and the biscuits, and they bring the talent.
Is it a strange experience? I mean, teaching. I mean, is it a constant learning curve for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not sure I'd say I'm teaching because I feel like I have no more experience than them, really, except, you know, in years. like, I read a lot and write a lot, and so do they. So really, I'm just facilitating, just kind of being the token adult in the group. And, you know, I'm learning a lot from them as well. So luckily, I have a really good group, and they're very... say well-behaved, so I don't feel like I'm having to control them or anything. I'm really just here as a facilitator. I can offer my opinion, but I always stress that it's no more important than theirs, really. I'm no more important. My opinion is no more important than theirs.
And in their writing, I mean, we're here in the beautiful surroundings of Dublin Castle, State Apartments. The courtyard is just outside. Do you see much of that coming through in their writing?
Well, the original, the first workshop was for writing historical fiction and fantasy. So that was our kind of emphasis in the first one. And certainly then the inspiration was clear, because a lot of them are working on historical fiction novels or on fantasy novels. And because there's still some medieval influences here on the site, medieval walls and some things to see, that kind of helped them, I think, visualize things. And you know, it's great to be in a place that's so inspirational, so I think they often think about that when they're writing.
Yeah, certainly. And what about, I mean, what did you expect setting out at the beginning of this writing group?
Do you know, I'm not 100% sure. I have been part of writing groups myself and I found them very helpful, and I thought it would be great if they could have a similar thing. So for young writers, because the aim is really for them to bring their own work and to share it. And I just kind of hoped that they would glean something from the experience and they'd be able to help each other along. And I think that they have done. They're certainly very like open and honest about their criticisms or what they admire about pieces, so that's really great to see.
So in terms of all of the guys writing, are you working towards anything? Is there a deadline or a goal in sight?
Well, certainly they all have their own individual aims. So some of them are working on novels and some of them are just working on, you know, developing their own style. We do have an exhibition coming up on the 25th of August here in the castle. It's probably going to be in the Chapel Royal, and that'll give them an opportunity to share some of their work and do some readings and sort of share their work with the general public and see, you know, everyone can see what we've been doing. We haven't just been eating biscuits and playing with story tubes.
What a great experience for a group. I mean, are they mostly kind of 15, 16?
14 to 17, yeah, most
14
of them.
To 17, and they'll be reading in the Chapel Royal in the Dublin Castle, their
yes.
own work.
Yeah, it's really exciting, actually. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. I think they are as well. It'll be a really great opportunity for them at such a young age to be getting this kind of exposure. So I think it'll be really, really interesting.
Of course, folks, the glitz and glamour of the DJ lifestyle gets one into all sorts of places. And lucky for me, a private tour around the castle itself was one of them.
Well, folks, you're very welcome. Thank you for joining me. This is Morgan O'Reilly on Writer's Block 90.3 Near FM, and I'm here in the beautiful surroundings of Dublin Castle to meet an old friend, Caoimhe Creed. How are you?
Hi, I'm very well. How are you?
Great, I'm great. I'm very delighted to be here. Thanks for having me. Well, let's get started, I suppose.
Let's go.
Staircase is gorgeous. Where are we now exactly?
So we're in the state apartments. This would have been the home of the Viceroy, who was the King's representative here in Ireland. So at the moment it's a government building after being handed over to the Irish people in 1922. So it's still an active government building. It's used for state dinners and, most interestingly, maybe the inauguration of the President, which takes place in St. Patrick's Hall, which we can see from here.
And gorgeous carpets and tapestries and chandeliers and beautiful 12-foot oak doors and everything.
Yeah, so the chandeliers are Waterford crystal, and the carpets were all hand-woven in Killybegs in County Donegal, specifically for the castle.
Okay, lovely, lovely stuff. Well, let's continue.
Okay, let's go this way.
Wow, it's a very impressive room. Where are we now?
So this is the drawing room. It takes its name from withdrawing, so this is where the ladies would withdraw to. This room was actually destroyed in a fire in 1941, and it was reconstructed then based on photographs and images. So yeah, this is where the ladies would withdraw to, so it was kind of the ladies' room. It's where they would wait as well before they were presented. So they would be presented aged 15 or 16, presented to the Viceroy or to the monarch, and after that they could go and find themselves an appropriate husband.
Of course, very important for young lady. Yeah. And we can see the courtyards.
So this is where the handover of power occurred. This is where the castle was handed back to Michael Collins on behalf of the Irish people, and where he said those famous words when he was accused of being 7 minutes late, and he said, "We've been waiting over 700 years, you can keep your 7 minutes." We can also see some interesting statues, actually. On either side of the Bedford Tower, there's those two arches, and on the left, there's a statue of Fortitude, and on the right is a statue of Lady Justice. And it's an unusual depiction of Justice because, first of all, she's not blindfolded. Justice should be blind. Mm-hmm. Also, she should be impartial, so her scales should always balance. But when this statue was first built, when it would rain, as it is today and is wont to do here in Dublin, the water would hit the scales, they would tip, and they'd be imbalanced. So this combined with the fact that, well, her sword is pointed upwards as well instead of downwards, and she's facing the castle and not facing the people of Dublin. So she came to kind of represent the injustice of British rule here in Ireland as they saw it. And it gave rise to a popular rhyme which went something along the lines of Lady Justice, mark her station, her face to the castle, her arse to the nation.
Lovely, and I can't help notice, but all of the European flags surrounding the courtyard and Greece and Germany are in our immediate view, so quite portentous to see Justice kind of administering between Greece and Germany.
Yeah, it's a good position.
Okay, let's move on.
So this is the aptly named throne room, the throne obviously being the kind of main focus of the room. It was built for the visit of King George IV, who, as you can probably guess, was a very large man, supposedly. I think he was 6'4", and they say he was as wide as he was tall. Probably hyperbole, but he was a glutton. That's how you got the nickname Georgie Porgy Pudding and Pie. And the rhyme goes on, kissed the girls and made them cry. George had a lot of mistresses. Many mistresses. When the boys came out to play, Georgie Porgy ran away. So he was not regarded as being a very brave man, but he was a generously sized king, and that's why we have this generously sized throne.
God, I never knew that nursery rhyme was about a king.
Yeah, a Georgie Porgy pudding and pie. Yeah, I'm sure they didn't say it to his face,
no,
but yeah, that was about him.
Okay, and beautiful paintings and artwork and mirrors all around the room as well.
Yeah, so these paintings are by an Italian painter, Gaetano Gadolfi, and the sort of unifying theme of the paintings is the power of the gods, which is quite a strong theme when you think about what this room is used for, and for a throne room. So we have Roman gods represented here in keeping with the theme of kind of neoclassical design that was very popular. Up on the top of the canopy there, actually, the lion and the unicorn are quite interesting. So it's the Lion of England and the Unicorn of Scotland. I get so many questions about why is it a unicorn? Why is there a unicorn up there? But it's the national emblem of Scotland. So that's why that's up there. And they're holding onto the Harp of Ireland there. So it's quite a possessive image, and when we got independence, they actually took these icons down. Then they did replace them at one point, but they've put them the wrong way around. So the lion and the unicorn should face inwards towards the crown, but here they're facing outwards instead. So whether or not that was on purpose, we don't know, we can't say.
They've turned their back on the throne.
So it would seem, yeah.
As have we. Okay, excellent stuff. Here, let's go.
Okay. Okay, so this is the portrait gallery, so called because of the portraits on the walls. These are some of the viceroys of Ireland, so they would have lived here, and this is where they entertained as well. And this room would have been used as a dining room. The dining table could have extended 6 feet beyond the carpet. You can't see the carpet, but that's massive. That's taking up most of the room.
It's about 60, 70 feet probably.
Yeah. So enormous. And they would have had a huge amount of food as well. So a normal dinner for the viceroy, like a normal evening meal, was about 16 dishes. And when he had a banquet, when he had people over, it would have been 30 to 34 different dishes. So huge amount of food. Also would have resulted in a lot of leftovers. They had a practice called the largesse, which was when they would use the leftovers to feed the starving people of Dublin. Now this was not as generous as it might sound. This was actually for their entertainment. So they would get up from their meal, leave all the leftovers all over the table. Someone would go into the street, call out largesse, and the starving mob would pour into the castle. Then the upper class would watch as the peasants fought over their food. And this was their after-dinner theatre, their entertainment.
Lovely.
Yes. Delightful. So from here we can see the Bedford Tower, and this is where the Irish crown jewels were stolen from. So these weren't the same as the English crown jewels, but it was the official regalia of the Order of St. Patrick. Now they were stolen in 1907, and the jewels have never been recovered, and the thief was never caught. So they assume it was an inside job, but apart from that they don't have any more clues as to what happened to them. So if anyone finds them, please return them to Dublin Castle.
They've never been recovered?
No.
Wow.
They've never been found. So it's been over 100 years, and we still don't know what happened to them. There are various theories, each one as ludicrous as the next. but some of them are quite interesting, but none of them have rang true yet anyway. Probably they're buried somewhere in someone's attic, God knows.
Wow, this room is breathtaking, I suppose is the only word. Where are we now, Cuiva?
This is St. Patrick's Hall, so it's the largest room in the castle. This is where we inaugurate the President of Ireland, so underneath that Irish flag there is where all nine of our presidents have been sworn in. So this room's very much still in use.
And, I mean, is it used for functions? Or?
Yeah, so this would be used for state dinners, also for corporate events. But when Queen Elizabeth II visited in 2011, she would have dined here in St. Patrick's Hall. So her first words were "Aguíní Uisle," in Irish honoured people. So it was very monumental, after all of our history, for her to be speaking Irish here in Ireland.
And I'm looking at a medal on the wall here. Perhaps you can tell me what this is.
So this is the Star of St. Patrick. It was the emblem of the Order of St. Patrick. This medal would have been awarded to all of the members of the Knights of St. Patrick. So they're also represented by the flags and plaques on the wall. So they represent the individual members. And this was basically the social elite. It was started by King George III as a way of rewarding or encouraging political loyalty. So gathering men of different beliefs under this one order.
Men of different beliefs. Could women be allowed into it?
No. No. Lord, no.
Beautiful paintings on the ceiling. Who is the painter? Are these significant of anything?
So the unifying theme here is the benefits that Britain has brought to Ireland. So over here you have St. Patrick, who is Welsh. Over here you have the submission of the Irish chieftains to the King of England in 1172. So this would represent the new civil order. And then in the middle you have George III, who started this most illustrious order of St. Patrick, which is celebrated here in St. Patrick's Hall. So that's the unifying theme. And the painter was an Italian painter named Vincenzo Valdre, and he was quite an eccentric man. He met his wife at a wedding, which is not so unusual, except that it was her wedding. So she was the bride. She was about to get married, but the day was almost ruined when the bridegroom failed to show up. Valdre was a guest at the wedding, and he said, "I'll marry the bride. We'll go ahead with the wedding. You know, let's not waste the cake." So they got married there and then, and they went on to have a pretty long and happy marriage after that.
Good for them.
Yeah, it was quite nice. Yeah.
Gentleman.
I know. He was a stand-up guy.
So, Cuiva, we are about to meet a group of fairly talented young writers. But I suppose my question is, why in the first place did you choose Dublin Castle as a setting for a kind of writing group like this?
Well, Dublin Castle is not just a historical building. I mean, we've been talking about history and social history and the relevance of the site, but it's also used for, as I said, a government building, still an active government building. It was once used as a hospital during the First World War, and it's used for the exhibition and preservation of art as well. So it has a lot of functions. It's not just a historical site. It's not a museum. We still want to keep it an active building, and so we want to have many other functions to it as well. So why not throw in a literary element?
So as well as all of these overlapping functions, I mean, you can't help but be inspired by the surroundings.
Exactly. Like, why not have it inspire some young writers? And we do walk around the rooms, and many of them are working on historical pieces or fantasy pieces that fit quite well in with the setting. So it is quite inspirational for them. And I guess it's nice to just add another feather to the cap of Dublin Castle. We do have a strong education programme, and this is just another part of that, I suppose.
Heading back to base now, armed with pencils, pens, and of course, biscuits.
Well, folks, cometh the hour, cometh the riders. Let's meet them.
We're all thrown wetsuits, and I think I'll skip the homoeroticism of the changing rooms. I went out of the changing room to put on my life jacket, and then the fun of finding the helmet began. Didn't fit, until a man who looked like the love child of Richard Gere and the Bull McCabe got me a helmet that would fit. Now that we all changed, my friend and I got into our canoe and got into the water with our peers. We all sailed together about halfway until my friend and I started to fall behind due to a gentle breeze.
That's Ed. Just one of a very talented group of young writers who gave me a very warm welcome to their own private wordsmithing forge deep in the heart of Dublin Castle. I was even privileged enough to be invited to a game of exquisite corpse. Yeah, I didn't know what it was either, but sure, anyway, have a listen.
So we call it the Foldy Story Game.
Really?
Huh? I found a whole Wikipedia page with
exquisite corpse.
Yeah. Yeah. Unless you were the pig.
No, yeah, I invented it.
July 26th, Exhibit Corpse.
Exquisite.
Exquisite Corpse, Exhibit A. That's your plan, he asked. Look, I know it's a long shot, but it's the best we've got, and we're running out of time. It had to work. Octopuses loved peas. But where do we find the peas? J.K. Rowling looked down and sighed. From the sunflower on top of that pyramid. This was a strange voicemail. I didn't recognise the number on my phone. I also had no credit. I was beginning to get tired, lost in the middle of nowhere with no phone credit and no TP. I missed my beautiful apartment with that stunning view and that skyrise building, but there was nothing I could do, so I made a campfire. A bee flew past me. These are like flying bricks. Technically, their wings shouldn't be able to. The monkey, full now of beans, started to whip all of the bees, trying to rid the campsite of them. The monkey's efforts, however, were in vain. The bees stung him. The elephant looked up from the puzzle he had been doing. What a shame, he said. But a quick shower should do the trick to soothe these stings. Head count. Who's missing? She feared the answer, but not as much as she feared going back having failed.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I don't think that one will be winning any Pulitzers anytime soon. But there was a real sense of fun that pervaded throughout the entire day, disproving every cliche that serious writers sometimes like to propagate about themselves.
The weirdest doll My Little Sister has was like a few years ago. You know there was the whole My Little Pony craze? Well, Bratz decided to cash in on that and they made Bratz ponies. But they have like Bratz faces and they just...
Oh god!
It actually, but it's getting annoyed at me because it looks more like a cow than a pony.
But don't be fooled by the giggling and the trick acting. They did have a keenness of mind and an intellect that was far beyond their years. Listen to these next few snippets, and I think you'll agree.
I've done a lot of things that I wouldn't have like thought to do on my own, like writing exercises and things.
Yeah.
And it's given me a lot of chances. Like I did a project with I did a project with the Print Museum, and we published a book of poetry with that. Then we did a project with the Science Gallery and Brown Bag Films, and then that won an animation award.
Do you find it difficult to practice that honesty yourself and to actually criticize someone else?
I did definitely at the start. But once I had one of my pieces kind of analyzed by the group, I realized how helpful it was.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, I should really give more.
And do you think then, I mean, training your own critical eye for someone else's stuff, does that help you then to criticize yourself?
Yeah, it does. It made me a lot more aware when I'm writing, when I'm kind of slipping into cliche or using too many adjectives, and it's just kind of, you just become a lot more aware in every aspect of your own writing, and it's really helpful. And then, you know, you miss out on some things or you fall in love with that one line that has absolutely no point to it, but it just has a really nice sound. And you need it, you know, you need the kind of, you do need people who really get it.
And in terms of helping for creativity, do you find being in a room with, like, you know, 10 other people, is that...
Yeah, because it's easy, we can bounce ideas off each other.
Yeah.
And then, like, one time I wrote a short story about a man who got burned alive. And I realised the next week that it was something similar to what someone else had actually wrote.
I
dealt with the way that I did it a lot different to the other person.
And
I didn't even realise until I read it out.
When you did realise, I mean, were you kind of angry at yourself? Or?
No, I apologised to him, but I didn't notice what I was doing.
That's quite funny.
Yeah.
You know, are you still finding your feet? You say you don't want to, you haven't really got one in mind, so...
Yeah.
Are you still finding your feet in terms of form and genre?
I think so. Like, when I first started writing, I kind of just wanted to emulate, like, old books. And that was all I really wanted to do. But I've kind of gone past that. I don't want to just write historical fiction that sounds like it's from the 1800s. I want to write something that's new.
Okay, and...
Like, I still like historical fiction, but I want to write it in a new kind of way.
that sounds to me like you're growing in confidence, you know, mm. just happy with reproducing yeah. stuff. You're actually coming up with
yeah, I want to be more original.
As I return to the outside world, in the slate grey Victorian skies and the dull and dreary Irish summer, with the famous courtyard at my back and all of its history, I know that there's plenty more stories to come from Dublin Castle yet.
Caoimhe Creed and the Dublin Castle Writers Group. Well, you are listening to Writers Block on 90.3 Near FM. Go to ads now, but stick around after the break. We have Madeline Gray coming in after 4 o'clock to chat to us about her novel and some of her poetry.
Songs and short stories, essays, so trying to win the favour of the nuns in school usually started with me writing a nice poem or a, you know, or a story, so it always worked in my favour, you know.
Was that when it started, back in childhood?
I think so, but definitely my mother was my absolute influence when I was a child growing up. She had 6 children and definitely she was a storyteller, and she raised us to appreciate the value of the word. So we were raised in Finglas, and yeah, Mammy definitely was giving us the value of stories. So, you know, there wasn't as much time to watch TV as there was talking and telling stories. I know it's something that I think is probably associated with most Irish families, but I think mm-hmm. it's dying. I think it's an art, or it's a family community pastime that's faded away.
And what's killing it? You mentioned TV there very briefly.
TV, definitely the internet. Definitely. Okay. You know, I see people don't have the time for reading books the way they did. And certainly people talking to each other and the stories and the value of it seems to be disappearing.
Fantastic. And come back to kind of your origins as a writer. I mean, you mentioned there that winning the praise of the nuns by writing a nice poem was part of it. Your mother was a big influence.
I definitely, like a lot of people that went to a convent school, definitely if you were in trouble with the nuns, your mother would ask you why you were causing problems in school and she probably gave you an extra slap. Yeah, my mother ever hit us, but yeah, definitely to try and win some kind of favour. I have a twin sister and she was always very bright and very articulate in school, mm-hmm. and I would have been a lot more shy and reserved, and I think writing probably was my better way of expressing myself. And my sister would have been the talkative person, and it happens a lot with twins. So as the quiet twin sister, my vocabulary and my pronunciation was very poor because my sister Patricia was always more articulate and more outgoing.
Excellent.
So I think writing was probably something that was necessary for me.
Excellent. So you began to interact with the world through the written word?
Yeah, and I think I was observing it that way, and it was safe for me to write it down. And certainly it was nurtured by my mother. And definitely when I went to secondary school, I had the blessing of being in the company of 5 wonderful girls who are still probably my best friends in the world. And these girls, even today, still nurture the writing, the passion that I have for writing, and definitely they would be my cheerleaders. Yeah, absolutely.
Going on from there, I'm interested in what's your favourite form, because you write, you mentioned at the top of the interview there, essays, poetry, prose,
yes.
and some of your published work. I mean,
well,
you've published a novel and you've got poetry on the way. So, I
yes,
mean, what kind
exactly.
of form are you drawn to?
All right, well, I'd say, Morgan, first of all, I had a book published last year, The Lighthouse, A Fairy Tale for the Brokenhearted. And it's a spiritual journey, and it's kind of like a fantasy fairy tale, as the subtitle will tell you. But people came back to me and said that they found it very poetic. And because of that, I went out to dinner at Christmas with my 5 lovely friends, and they all demanded that I start putting out more of my poetry because they grew up with it.
Okay.
And they would be very familiar with me as writing poems, and they would have been used in the school and at school masses and all kinds of stuff like that. So it would have been something that I would have been recognised for doing. And they thought, where are your poems? Why aren't they coming out? So really, with them pushing it, I said, OK, let's put the book of poetry out.
OK, so it was actually poetry was your first love?
I don't think so. I think no. The first love is just the word. It's the word. Mm-hmm. And whether the word belongs on the stage, whether it's in a song or whether it's in a sentence, I love language, and I love voice, and I love the freedom to express myself, and the right of other people to be able to express themselves, I think, is life.
That's wonderful. I mean, to hear that the word is your first love, but yeah, to me it makes things complicated. I mean, when you sit down at the desk, do you have an idea? I want to write a prose. I want to write poetry.
I'm a walker, and I don't drive, mostly by choice, but I don't drive. I'm a walker, and if I have to commute, I find a lot of what I write. I can look at any of my poems, and I know where I was when those poems were kind of developing in my imagination. And a lot of that happened just not by sitting in front of a blank page, but by being out there in the city, by walking around, and just being in my own company. And I'm quite happy to be in my own company.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, let's go to your poetry now.
Okay.
What is the collection called?
The collection is called Shafts. Shafts being shafts of light. So the beauty of my life experience, particularly growing up in a working class environment, okay, and especially the company of my lovely mother and my siblings and my father and my friends. That would be shafts of light.
Indeed.
The other part of the title is shards, and shards being broken glass, and the pain of life's experiences that I think I absolutely know that we all experience, we can all share and identify with that. So they're contrasts of shafts and shards.
And does that theme run throughout the book?
Yes, it does, it does. Yeah. Without me even trying to do that, I found reading back on poems, light was there, but mm-hmm, definitely the splinters are there as well, yeah, the bleed that we all know about, you know.
And is this your first time attempting to publish your poetry?
No, I had stuff published about 25 years ago, okay, and that wouldn't have been me. That was the poems were chosen by another collection.
Okay.
So they put together some of my poems in a particular anthology of poetry.
But it was only on the insistence of your five girlfriends
that have asked me to bring out Shafts Shards, yes. Excellent. So that's why it's going to be published in November.
November. Excellent, excellent. Looking forward to that. And so tell us about some of the poems. I was just, some of the information you gave me. It's a life's work, really. It's 25
years. Well, there's 25 years of poems. A lot of them are actually fairly new, fairly recent. They would relate to maybe a movie that I watched earlier this year, was one of my poems, that's called Whiplash. And I just loved that movie so much that I wrote a poem about it straight away because it was just so inspiring. Anyone that hasn't seen it, oh my God. So yeah, I loved that, and I dedicated it to my mother's grandchildren, and it would be me saying, do it, get out there and do it. And I think because I've chosen to publish my work, I would say to people, don't wait for anyone to give you the opportunity, give yourself the opportunity. Do it for yourself. If you can't, wait for somebody else to knock at the door and do favours or give you the opportunity that you're waiting for. Mm-hmm. Just do it for yourself. And that's Whiplash is my way of saying that to my daughter and my niece and nephews.
And that was just one poem. But getting back to that, I mean, yeah, getting up and doing it yourself. Will your collection of poems be self-published, or is it?
Yes, they are self-published, and they are with the support.
Like?
Well, it was actually more simple than you'd realise, yeah, and the publishers they do so much of the work for you. So they put your work out on Amazon, and they promote it with bookshops and stuff like that. You know,
excellent.
So but like I would still do a lot of the legwork myself, which of course I want to do. So
indeed,
you know, it's great because writing is a kind of solitary occupation. Some people would say it's lonely, but I think it's lonely if you don't like your own company. I never feel lonely. It's a solitary occupation.
Is it an ugly side of the business, the legwork, as you said there?
No, I wouldn't say it. No, it's not. It's like coming out of a hut, kind of.
Okay.
And just when you're getting cabin fever, you can come out and it's like, breathe the fresh air and meet the people like you, Morgan, and say, hey, I'm here, you know. I come back out into the air again, into the sunshine, and get out and interact with people.
And get more ammo for the next phone.
For the next, well, that's it. Like, you know, it's just working with students and colleagues and neighbours, just the everyday people in your life. That's where all your sources come from.
Lovely, lovely. And back to, I mean, you mentioned that poem there, Whiplash.
Whiplash.
And you wrote it.
Will I read that one out, Morgan? Do you want me to read it?
Absolutely, if you'd like to read it now.
I have it here. It's very short, actually. It's not a long poem. And it's dedicated to my mother's grandchildren. Whiplash. Go back. Don't wait to be embraced by one who loves you too much to have you bleed. You must bleed. You must love yourself more by turning back and making your great noise. May your blood, sweat and tears drench your stage before you ever make your exit.
Lovely imagery there, blood.
Yeah, blood, sweat and tears. Yeah. Like, we all know about it, but it's like saying, give it your best shot. Don't go down without a fight. And if somebody says no, if you've seen the movie Whiplash, my God, stay where you are and just fight back.
Excellent. But you wrote it, you wrote that poem, as you said, kind of very spontaneously. You saw this film and it was a sudden inspiration. What about the rest of the poems in the
collection? They're like that as well. Yeah, they would always be like that. I would never, I have never in my life said, okay, today I'm going to write a poem. That would never happen. That just wouldn't happen.
And where does the inspiration come from?
I think it's my only way of absorbing something. If something is there hanging around in my head because of experience or a memory, like the light that comes in through my window at in the evening, that last light, there's always that stretch of light in the evening just before the day ends. And people are like that before they die. They get this burst, this last light of life, energy, before they die. And I love that last light. And the memory of that light reminds me of a memory that I had with my mother, something that I had said to her, and that inspired a poem, because I remember the light beaming through my window and I thought, I was thinking of my mother and something I had said to her. So I have it here as a poem. Will I read it?
Yeah.
I'll go on with it. Okay.
What's this one called?
This one is called My Mother's Light. It was that last light of, it was that last light I loved, and I told her so. That stretch of day before fading behind the church steeple, leaving an orange glow over the rooftops and chimneys of Finglas West. It was that last light she remembered me by. This is Madeline's light, she'd say, and try to catch a dusty beam to give to me. And it is that same light of evening that brings her back to me now. That yawn at day's closing that brings her quietly to my side. Never could she give such light until she died.
Beautiful, beautiful.
Oh, thanks, Morgan.
I say it every time when a writer comes in to read their poetry in the studio. There's nothing like hearing a poem from the poet themselves.
Really?
Yeah,
that's lovely.
When you hear it in their own voice.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you. I never thought about that before.
But getting back, we were chatting briefly there about inspiration for the poems, and just from the work that I've read and from some of the stuff that you've even read out today, place and, but what's more, women seem to be a massive theme in your work,
both in your
novel and throughout your poetry, kind of strength and resilience.
Yes, absolutely.
And even in maternal, that's a very maternal poem there.
It is, yeah, absolutely, Morgan. I would say that women are my greatest influences throughout my life, whether it's my mother, my grandmother's, even my husband's mother, who I just knew briefly before she died, and also my daughter. So yes, women are definitely the influences in my life, and of course my lovely friends, and my twin sister, who the book is dedicated to, by the way.
We were chatting just briefly before you came on air. We were chatting about kind of the importance that your voice as a woman, and I think it's very true of you to say. I mean, although we are getting better, and there's a lot of campaigns on at the moment, the Read Women campaign, for example. But I mean, if people went home and looked at their bookshelves today and counted how many titles were by men and how many titles were by women, it would probably be, I don't know, 80, 20, 70, 30.
It's still very poor. Last week we were looking at some art programme and my husband said to me, isn't it strange the way men are all great painters and there were no women painters? I had to be tied down because, like, I had to tell him, look, women, what do you think women were doing when men were painting their portraits? Women were raising children. And we're here today because of those women in the past who raised children. And the society that we live in, Coolock, Finglas, wherever your living. We have what we have because women went silently to their graves and put all their energy and their love and their hearts into community. But unfortunately, they go silently to their graves and they say nothing. They don't leave themselves behind in any way. There's no voice there that I could find anyway. I think Paula Meehan would be one of the few women that I have seen speak. She doesn't. She works across the classes. Her work is not, it's not class. But I recognise the working class woman in her poems. I see it and I feel it. It's very hard to find it. In any woman's creative life. And I would say that internationally. I did my master's with UCD in women's studies, and women's history is, besides literature, women's history would be very, very important to me. So the voice of the woman and the silence associated with a woman. We know next year is a big year in Ireland, 2016, and we have a certain section of a group of women who were at the forefront of the rebellion. That's marvellous. But there were ordinary women like my great-grandparents and yours who were fighting the fight as well. Yeah. We just don't know about it. We just never hear about it. We know men's history because they go to war, and war is recorded by men. But a woman's story is never recorded. They go silently to their grave.
And just play, I mean, it's great to have a Northsider into the studio.
Yay!
And just place, I mean, you've been talking about the city centre, you've been talking about Finglas and Coolock there, you mm-hmm. mentioned. Does place play a big part in your poetry and your prose?
It does. It comes in there whether you write what you know. You write what you know, and if I had grown up in a different environment, I would probably be writing about, you know, the coast, the beach, seashells, and I would be writing about a different experience. But because I grew up in a working class environment, my poems are expressing the voice of the working class woman, because that's who I am.
Yeah. And if we can just, if I can briefly switch subject here to just challenge you on that one.
Yes.
We write what we know, and yet mm-hmm. Your novel, The Lighthouse, a fairy mm-hmm. tale for the brokenhearted, it's a fairy tale, isn't it?
It's a fairy tale, but all fairy tales have always been expressing something that's real and true. Mm-hmm. You know, we all know the Cinderella, we all know the Beauty and the Beast kind of stories. We can place them in our society today. The Lighthouse is the fisherman's daughter, and in that story she is seen as she has no name because she's just called the fisherman's daughter. But fantasy is, it's an interpretation of the society that we live in.
There's a genre in literature. I think Salman Rushdie is very famous for it. Mm. Magical realism. And
yeah.
when I was reading parts of your novel,
yes,
that was the first thing that leapt
okay,
off.
Okay, that's not a, that's quite a kind yeah. of comparison. Thank you very much for that. Wow. Okay. Well, yes, I know what you're saying. It is. It's a magical world, but a lot of the events that transpire in the lighthouse are quite real. They're real. Mm. The hurt, the pain is real, and the happiness.
And what drew you to that genre? Were you drawing upon
death, death, and what happens to us? Spiritualism. What happens to us has always been my question. I'm fascinated with the idea of the spirit world and the idea of angel. What is angel? What is that? Is it a fantasy? Is it something that has been made up? And or is it something that is very real that we just haven't discovered yet? If you recall, maybe 200 years ago, we didn't know anything about germs. Nobody knew that germs are a cause of disease until the microscope was developed. And lo and behold, what do we find under the microscope? Germs. We couldn't see them with the human eye, but they were there. Maybe the energy of our spirit, our loved ones, maybe that energy does actually exist around us, but we haven't developed or found that microscope yet that can help us to identify with that.
Is that one of the quests that the fisherman's daughter pursues?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, she knows there's something more and she wants to find it. She knows the lighthouse has something there. And you have to read the book to know what happens there.
We'll say no more.
Yeah, okay.
And back to the poetry, you were saying earlier that Paula Meehan is definitely one of your...
Yeah, she would be one of my... yeah, absolutely. When my mother died, I remember one of her books, speaking about angels again, her book fell out of a shelf from a library over in Ballymun, and I opened the book and there was a beautiful poem, The Ghost of My Mother Comforts Me. And wow, you read to know you're not alone. I'm going back to that again. Mm. I certainly knew that somebody out there knew what it was like to lose your mother, to bury your mother. And she was speaking with my voice. It was a similar experience. And she said what I was feeling inside of myself, that loneliness, but so also a reassurance knowing that nobody's really gone forever. They continue. I think we continue to have a relationship with people even after they've died. The relationship changes, but they are still a part of your life.
A part of your mother will reside within you, and then will reside
exactly,
within the next generation.
Exactly. It makes me think. My husband has a great relationship with his mother, and I say has because it's in the present tense. His mother died 17 years ago, but he continues to have a relationship with her. And one of my poems, it's near the end of the book Shafts Shards, is my idea of one day looking at my husband and his hands are like his mother's hands, and it influenced a poem that I wrote.
And maybe we'll hear that poem.
Can we? Because it would be a nice, appropriate way to wind up. Because, Morgan, I'll just say that it is her anniversary on Monday, and I'll just read this one for my husband, okay? All right, my husband has his mother's hands. My husband has his mother's hands, made for mending broken things, stems and hems, an injured paw, wings. He tends the yellow roses, cuts them back to grow. He knows the language of the sky, its gifts of sun and snow. My husband has his mother's hands and his mother's heart, I'm sure. It went on beating after burying a son and knows one cure. To rise and see the morning, put 2 feet on the floor. Face the day, just like the way his old lady did before.
Lovely.
Thank you.
No, I mean, again, there's a real sense of opposites in that poem. Again, stems and hems, there's light and dark.
Yeah, you got that. Yeah, the stems. David, my husband, loves gardening, and his mother was a natural born gardener before him, and all of his family, total green fingers. They're just all, we have a window box on our living room window because we don't have a front garden. It's a terraced house, and there's literally a tree in the window box, and I'm not lying. It's becoming, I said to him today on the way over to the studio, what are we going to do about that tree? And he said, it has to stay there. It's part of the street now. Everybody knows. And I said, I think birds are going to start nesting in it. Like, it's huge. It's actually a window box. But anyway, yes, stems would be a reflection of David as a gardener and his relationship with his mother and his family. Mm-hmm. They are gardeners. Hems, mending clothes.
Briefly, before we were on air, we were having a little chat about poetry kind of in modern Ireland, and you were making the point that you think it's coming back.
I do think so.
If it ever went away.
I really think so. And I'll tell you why. You go into Penny's and you see T-shirts with slogans, little sentences, dream, follow your dreams kind of sentences. You find cups, cushions, it's everywhere, posters on the wall. People need words. People are not finding the time to read a book, but they may still find time to read a poem. And I do believe that sentences and just words are inspirational to our society today. And I see it everywhere now. I'm seeing language and just simple words of inspiration everywhere. And I believe that we are ready to pick up a poetry book again. Maybe not to read a book, a novel, follow a story through, but there are little stories in a book of poetry. And I think that I hope I have put that together.
Lovely. It just occurred to me there. You forget that we've such a rich kind of literary history in Ireland here now.
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot of the things you were talking about, you see it on cups, you see it on t-shirts.
Yeah.
It's sometimes it's tourism, and you can get quite cynical about it.
Yes.
And you can say it's just for the Americans coming over.
Yeah.
But it's still Irish words on Irish
You
products,
see that yeah. in certain Irish souvenir shops that we won't mention. But if students are listening to me, they know the shop I'm talking about. But I mean that you can find paintings and poetry written on, like, posters and pictures on walls. Mm-hmm. You're seeing these words written up now, more than I've ever noticed before.
And you say you think we need the written word.
We do, we need it. We need to know that we're not alone, and that that writer said what I'm feeling.
Mm-hmm.
That writer knows my heart, that I'm not alone out here.
Can I ask you, who do you think needs it? I mean, the obvious thing would be young people.
Wow.
Who would be going into pain.
Everybody. The lonely 85-year-old man living out in Offaly, and his family don't phone him. And the teenager, the child who might be bullied, the mother who doesn't know how to pay for her children's school books or school uniform, the homeless people. I just have to walk to work every day, and they're sleeping in doorways. They are everyone in society needs words. We need it. It's like oxygen.
Mm-hmm. And there's, speaking of words, there's a fabulous festival on next month, the Lingo Festival. I'm not sure if you're
I'm not heard of the Lingo Festival.
It's a spoken word festival, and there'll be a series of, I mean, poetry readings and...
All right, okay.
Near FM will be heavily involved in broadcasting, but it's something very, very close to what you're talking to. And there would be a huge amount of young people, and it wouldn't be kind of classical poetry.
Right, okay, right. Yeah, well, like you were saying earlier on about rap being the poetry of today, like these rap artists. So, I mean, it's not something that belongs 200 years ago. We need these words. We need it today.
And, I mean, what do you think about that kind of innovation? I mean, you could talk about rap, and you can talk about, you know, the slam poetry that we see in a lot of places as well today. Is that healthy for them?
Of course it is. Yeah. It's breaking down walls. To give somebody the platform to express themselves is absolutely necessary. We need it. We are supposed to live in a democratic society, and we need to go hand in hand with our creative lives as well. They need to go together to move forward in our society. So yes, I would say definitely there's always a platform for it. There's always a platform for the voice and to speak out and say, I'm here.
Beautiful. On that sentiment, I think we're just drawn to a close now, unfortunately, Madeline, but we'd love to, maybe if you'd like to finish out on one poem, I'll give you a second there to have a look and see what you'd like to read.
Okay.
That's all we have time for today, folks. You've been listening to me, Morgan O'Reilly, on Writer's Block 90.3 FM. Big thanks to my guest, Madeline Grace.
Thanks, Morgan.
Again, if you'd like to contact the show, you can email me morgan_O'Reilly@live.com, or you can get us on Twitter @Morgan_O'Reilly, and all the events and the info and the podcasts and everything will be put up on Twitter. But for the moment, Madeline is going to give us one more poem.
All right, thanks, Morgan. Okay, this poem is written for my grandmother, and her name is Josie. Josie, when you left, I said, I'll mark your X upon the bark of my tree, and they will know that you had been here because of me. But having no sword, and little can I afford except to sing and praise the things that you knew in basements.